Hello and welcome to Consumer Choice Radio, now broadcasting as a podcast. Thank you all for subscribing over there on consumerchoiceradio.com and on all the platforms available out there. You name it, Spotify, Apple, and the rest. So we got something special today. We're going to do a little deep dive on net neutrality. And we're going to do it with a friend of the show, Evan Schwarztaube. Not only is he a great voice for innovation and policy, he's also host of the Dynamist podcast, which I very much recommend, and a senior advisor over there at the Foundation for American Innovation. He was himself at the FCC for a few years, so he kind of knows the inside baseball of this stuff. And since net neutrality is once again on the docket, we figured we'd get a little bit of hint as to what this is all about with him. So listen in. This is our interview with Evan Schwarztaube. Evan, good sir, how goes it today?
It's great. Every time I hear my last name pronounced correctly, I'm going to be honest, it's a little jarring.
Let's see Paul Allen's card.
Yeah, you got to do things correctly around here. So, Evan, you have unique perspective on the net neutrality or Title II reclassification issue. I know that you have been very vocal about it on X and many other social media sites, but you previously worked at the FCC, which is currently unveiling this proposal. So if you could just give a little background to those who might not be net neutrality nerds, what does net neutrality mean when it is promulgated by an agency like the FCC?
Yeah, that's one of the funny things about this debate is that no one can actually agree on what net neutrality means. If you read a news article, it'll generally use the, I hate to even say colloquial definition, right, but the most common definition, which is that, you know, internet service providers should not be able to block lawful traffic, throttle lawful traffic, or discriminate against internet traffic in a way that harms consumers. The classic example I like to use is when the term was created back in 2003, Tim Wu, who went on to become a Biden economic advisor, Columbia professor, he identified a concern that if an internet service provider, think Comcast, owned a content company like NBC, that they would use their position as an internet provider to screw over their competitors, right? They would slow down ESPN, speed up NBC, consumer decides to unsubscribe from ESPN, right? That's a really worst case scenario. A lot of folks on my side of the aisle and in the kind of free market world say that would obviously be an antitrust violation. You don't need new regulation. But generally speaking, it's a concept, it's a principle. The internet should be open and free, and ISPs shouldn't use their position to harm the lawful flow of internet traffic.
Yeah, perfect. And that's, companies like Comcast, CenturyLink, just wherever you get your internet. Could even be Google Fiber if that's in your backyard, or Elon Musk's Starlink.
Right. And there are thousands of small ISPs in the country as well that, serve rural areas. But there are some big ISPs that kind of capture like 80% of the market.
So going back to the history of this, we had Tom Wheeler, former chairman of the FCC, and that's when the net neutrality debate first came to the fore. And you at that time were working, was it also as a policy advisor to then?
I was at Tech Freedom.
Okay, you were at Tech Freedom at that time. All right. And this is the first proposal animated everybody, and you obviously were aware of it. I'm sure you commented on it. That first version, what was the excuse that was sort of invoked in order to pass this?
Right. I'm glad you asked that because the goalposts have changed over the years, right? The justification for the regulation has changed as conditions on the ground have changed. But back in, 2014, 2015, there was a famous John Oliver bit, on his HBO show Last Week Tonight, got the country riled up about what had previously been a largely academic and legal debate, right? It was very strange to see an issue like net neutrality getting so much mainstream press attention and having, average Americans paying attention. And that was deliberate. There was a deliberate move to try to make a big deal out of something that arguably wasn't that big of a deal. But essentially, the argument was, without regulation, companies like AT&T, et cetera, will, throttle Netflix, right? They'll say, we're going to slow down Netflix traffic unless Netflix pays us a ransom or a toll. We're going to create fast lanes and slow lanes. And then the predictions, you know, got even more insane. But, you know, back in 2015, it was really without regulation, you can't have free speech on the internet. Never mind that there wasn't a dystopia before 2015, but essentially activists pointed to a handful of examples, all of which for the most part got resolved without these rules, but a handful of examples of internet providers, you know, doing something that was quote unquote not neutral, saying we're going to block Skype because it uses too much bandwidth, things like that, or we're going to partner with YouTube only so you can only stream YouTube on your 4G, but if you try to stream on Hulu, it's 3G. So those sorts of arrangements, which, you know, were pretty uncommon, but, you know, activists pointed to a few examples of quote-unquote non-neutral behavior to say we need net neutrality. And so the FCC under Chairman Wheeler, he was President Obama's, in his second term, the later part of his second term, he was the chairman, he decided to reclassify ISPs, broadband providers, as Title II common carriers, essentially like a telephone company. And they said they needed to do that because that was the only legally sustainable way of enforcing net neutrality.
I see, legally sustainable. It's funny, you mentioned the John Oliver bit, and it's very true. I went back and looked at my own archives that I have on my own site. I wrote an article in March of 2015. I was being very condescending. I said, British comedian John Oliver cheers FCC's net neutrality regulation. And it's true. John Oliver did this a lot and still does. You know, he'll do a segment and then he'll actually have a call to action. You know, send this message to whatever office, sign for this, you know, regulatory comment proposal thing. And, you know, he had this idea and I took a quote from that. It's like, yes, cable and telephone companies will not be allowed to create a two-tiered fast lane and slow lane on the internet. That's what he was celebrating. Right. Obviously, that was the kind of big impetus here. So bring us through the timeline. We had this. It went through. We had, during that time, net neutrality, this Title II classification that came in, and kind of what happened after that.
Yeah, so a brief history, because this could take 2 hours if we wanted it to, but we don't want that. So, right, the term goes back to 2003. It was really an academic discussion. For the most part, the idea of net neutrality has been bipartisan throughout its existence. It just had different flavors in terms of what was the role of government in enforcing it, and what was the role of the marketplace, and what role did the expectations of consumers play. So you had, you know, Michael Powell, Colin Powell's son. He was chairman of the FCC under George W. Bush. He put out, you know, principles of internet freedom, which was basically net neutrality, right? He didn't say we're going to come in heavy-handed government and enforce this, but it was basically like guidelines. And for the most part, internet service providers upheld them. Then we had lighter touch net neutrality rules that got struck down by the courts. Chairman Wheeler, 2015, puts in place Title II. This is strong, right? Strict net neutrality, closer to what they have in the EU. Ajit Pai, my former boss, comes in under the Trump administration, repeals those rules. Both the Wheeler rules and the repeal of those rules got upheld by the courts. The courts basically said, you can do either one. You could have internet be a Title I information service, less regulated, or you could have it as a Title II common carrier, more regulated. So now we're in another iteration of this debate, right? You have President Biden. The expectation is if a Democrat controls the FCC, you got to put Title II back, just like the expectation might be for a future Republican FCC to get rid of it. That's why we call this a regulatory ping pong. It's very silly. Congress should just step in here and decide what the rules of the road are. But because Congress doesn't do that, we have this back and forth. So now the FCC is putting Title II back because they finally have the 3-2 Democratic majority they need to do that. But the interesting thing that I want to hone in on is the justification has changed, right? Because back in 2017, when Ajit Pai repealed net neutrality, the predictions were insane. It is important to remember that because I, for one, believe that when people are that wrong, they should be held accountable. If you predict the apocalypse and the apocalypse doesn't happen, there should be egg on your face. You think back to Y2K, right? There was a lot of people that looked really silly when they said the world would end because the date on your computer only showed two digits and it went from 99 to 00 and the computer would explode and planes would fall out of the sky, right? None of that happened. There were people that said activating C-band 5G spectrum would cause planes to fall out of the sky. That didn't happen.
Or right? Today, so AI will wipe out humanity.
Exactly, right? Like, there should keep track of people's crazy predictions and then hold them accountable. Unfortunately, the press in this case don't do a great job of holding them accountable. You get vague references to heated rhetoric. But seriously, CNN ran a headline, the end of the internet as we know it. You had people saying that ISPs were going to block access to abortion websites for whatever reason, right? Just pick any sort of thing that had any sort of political angle to it, and the internet service provider would exploit that, block that, right? They imagine these people as, like, Satan, right? They're going to just abuse this power for all sorts of nefarious ways. None of that stuff happened. Literally none of it. The internet got faster. The internet got more available. Speeds have gone up exponentially, even during COVID, when there was all this demand. So none of that happened. So what does that mean? The FCC wants to do the same regulations, but they can't say it's about free speech because ISPs are not the ones blocking free speech, right? That's the big tech companies who actually supported net neutrality, and we can get into that maybe later in the show. But the debate about free speech on the internet has nothing to do with ISPs. It's about app stores. It's about social media. It's about cloud providers. It's about misinformation and disinformation boards, right? That's where the free speech is. ISPs don't police speech. They are conduits that, you know, unless it's illegal speech or like copyright infringement in the EU, they block a lot of piracy websites. But if it's lawful speech, ISPs are pretty much hands-off approach. So the FCC today is saying they need to do this for national security. Now, I think that your listeners might be rolling their eyes right now because it's not uncommon for the federal government to claim broad power under the guise of national security. And often they name it something that sounds great. The Patriot Act, for example, right? If you don't support this, you're un-American. If you don't support warrantless surveillance, you are not a patriot, right? So now it's, if you don't support net neutrality, you want the country to be unsafe. So they're saying they need this to block, you know, foreign threats. And I'm not going to bore listeners, but this is a red herring. The U.S. government has all the authority it needs to block Chinese carriers from offering services in the United States. We've already gone after Huawei. We've done a lot on national security. The one thing we haven't done is ban TikTok. That has nothing to do with the FCC. But this is the new justification, national security and public safety, right? Outages, wildfires, et cetera. So it's a Christmas tree of bad things that could happen if we don't have rules. And the goalposts keep shifting, as Commissioner Carr said, but the goal's always been the same, government control of the internet.
So I want to peel back a layer of the onion here and go back to your own experience. I found an article from the trade magazine Broadcasting and Cable that announced that you had joined as a policy analyst. This is in December of 2017, which coincidentally is around the repeal of the net neutrality rules by Ajit Pai. So what was it like sort of being on the inside after this had gone through? What was the sort of atmosphere there? Because the FCC does have, we don't want to say partisan commissioners, but you have commissioners that are either put up by different parties or different ideological elements. What was it like on the inside in this net neutrality repeal era?
Yeah, that was really the most exciting time, but also the stupidest time, because those two things are directly related. When the FCC does 99% of its work, there's like very few people that attend these open meetings. Yeah, they're public meetings. Anyone can show up. Not anyone can speak, but anyone can, you know, watch the meeting. And then there's press conferences. Very little attention gets paid to this agency unless there's some big political item. In 2017, I started 1 week before the repeal vote. So I get there, I set up my Twitter account, and immediately just the hate I am getting for just expressing, you know, banal opinions like we don't need to regulate here because it's overreach and it will be bad for investment and innovation, right? Like very classic things I believe, right? But not controversial opinions. Can I curse on this show?
Yeah, we are off the radio and all podcast only now, so FCC rules don't apply.
So my favorite insult ever that I got on Twitter, and some of my friends actually have me in their cell phones under this name, is you know, I probably said something like Title II is bad for investment, or it caused investment to reduce and getting rid of it will be good for investment, which is true. I got a response. Someone called me a corporate fuck muppet, which is actually really funny and definitely the best insult I've ever heard in my life. Someone else said I had a huge effing forehead, and someone else said this Evan dude looks like a gimp. So I had some really good ones. I posted them on Instagram for all my friends and family to see so that they could see that I had reached the level in my career where people could hurl invective my way, right? I really was proud of that. In terms of the atmospherics, right, massive protests outside the FCC, like more people than you'll ever see at a sleepy agency. You had the Democratic commissioners speaking to the crowd, you know, riling them up, you know, doing calls and response. The room was absolutely packed. And because of the angry mob that got whipped up by the left, we had a bomb threat called into the FCC. So, you know, the same people that say words are violence and that, you know, every time the President Trump opens his mouth, it's dangerous. These are the folks that, you know, whipped up an angry mob that caused death threats against Chairman Pai and the other commissioners. They had to have round-the-clock security for, you know, the better part of a year. He had to cancel his appearance at the Consumer Electronics Show. There was a man convicted of credible threats against him and his family, and you had activists in his neighborhood putting up flyers saying, written to his children, saying, when you grow up, you'll realize how much of a POS your dad is, right? So, like, it was truly despicable, and I know it sounds like I'm harping on something from the past, but I just think it's so important in this debate not to lose sight of how absurd everything was, so that when the same people who contributed to that absurdity now want those regulations back in place, there's lots of policy reasons why it's a bad idea, but there's also a credibility reason.
We live in a dark moment.
These people are not credible.
Yeah, dark moment.
exactly. It was a dark
moment. You bring up...
And now it's much sleepier debate.
Yeah. And I want to go to that because you talked about sort of the opposition and in the, or I guess at that point, let's talk about the proponents early on in that first first run. I remember that the internet, you know, if we can call it the internet, right? All the popular websites, I remember Reddit, you know, it was all like blackout day. Net neutrality is just integral to internet freedom, mm-hmm. online content. And, you know, I was a big opponent of it, having, you know, reported on it and understood it and put out some comments, and I got nothing but hate as well. And it's the same today.
Yeah.
You know, just any comments that we've sent out as Consumer Choice Center or things that we put online, you know, this is the kind of thing to where we get the most vitriol ever. And there's been you mentioned, a misunderstanding of what the actual threats are on the internet in 2023, but just a misunderstanding of what this project is about and what it actually does. So, you know, when there was this Title II classification, and you mentioned, you know, this is what you do for internet companies. It's what I've learned now also applies to like the freight railroads, this kind of common carrier where government has more of a hand in regulating things. You know, what are the downsides of this kind of new version? Is this a different proposal, you think, than the first one that actually went through? Is it a bit more dangerous? Is it more sinister? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say it's very similar in large part to the Title II rules of the past. The one key difference is that national security justification actually does have a policy underlying it, and that's this idea that ISPs will now need a license to operate in the United States or to discontinue service. And, you know, we've seen licensing become a political football at communications regulators before. Yael, you're Canadian. Your home country's regulator has proposed licensing podcasts, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that after.
And there was naturally a lot of backlash to that, thinking like, well, you're going to use that authority for something, right? I mean, this is the Trudeau government. We know he doesn't like people criticizing him. And we saw some of the choices that were made regarding the trucker protests, with folks having their bank accounts, you know, implicated and having, you know, GoFundMe taking people down because they didn't agree with their politics, right? Licensing is a political issue. And we've seen a lot of the same groups that support net neutrality have asked the FCC to revoke Fox's broadcast license because Fox News said whatever about the 2020 election, right? So there's, and I'm being flippant, but, you know, there's we have a strong First Amendment in the United States for a reason, and we've seen the government try to get around the First Amendment by using whatever hooks they can into these companies, right? Some of it is jawboning big tech, as you've seen, right? Going after them on antitrust or Section 230 and then saying, oh, you know, while we're suing you on these other grounds, it'd be really great if you took down this account that's criticizing Hunter Biden, right? Like that's the type of stuff that the government can do to get around it. So on its face, right, Section 214 authorization looks great, right? Because it says we need to make sure you're not a national security threat to operate in the United States. The FCC has revoked that authority for several Chinese carriers because of their ties to the Communist Party. It's, you know, the legal distinction is they revoked their voice service, right? They didn't have the authority to do the broadband thing. Now, one could imagine that authority being abused against American companies, right? If you're an American company and you now need a license from the FCC to offer broadband, the FCC has a lot of power to license and unlicense people. The standard is really the quote-unquote public interest standard. It's so vague, and a lot of conservatives and libertarians have been criticizing this standard for, you know, 100, close to 100 years at this point, saying, it, what does it mean? Like, what does the public interest mean? And you're just allowing five bureaucrats to interpret that vague standard. So I would, you know, long answer, but I would just say the key difference is this national security piece does open up potential layers of abuse. But the big problem with Title II has always been its impact on investment and innovation. And the reason the tech companies wanted it was because they wanted the FCC to give them the upper hand in negotiations with ISPs for whether or not they get charged to carry traffic, right? And this is a controversial issue all over the world. You've seen it in South Korea, you've seen it in Europe, et cetera. But they just wanted to make sure that the government came in and said, you cannot charge too much to Google or Reddit for interconnecting with our network. They won that battle, man. Like with or without these rules, the tech companies won that argument, which is why they're not engaging this time around. They really don't seem to care because they know that they've won, and bandwidth is also not scarce, right? Like you said, we've got satellites going up, we've got 5G. You know, this idea that there's bandwidth scarcity, at least in the United States, separate problem in Europe, the United States, we're not seeing that be a major concern. The big concern now is rate regulation. And you have this administration saying we're not going to regulate broadband prices, but it's a shell game. They're figuring out any way they can. And while the FCC today may say we're not going to use these rules to regulate broadband prices, at any moment they can just, quote unquote, unforbear from those rules and put them in place. And a future FCC that is maybe more radical than the current one could do it in a heartbeat. So when you're a smaller ISP in particular, and you're trying to get financing to build broadband in rural America, and those Wall Street lenders look at the FCC and say, well, what if they set a price that's too low for me to get a return on my investment? They're not going to lend to you, or they're less likely to lend to you. So that's really it. The free speech stuff was always a smokescreen. It's not really at issue today. It's all about control over these companies. And Title II gives the FCC the power to police their terms and conditions, their pricing plans, their build out. They can sue them for building fiber in one neighborhood and not another. There's just so much power that comes with these rules. And the fact that when they say we're not going to use all that power, right, that's just an empty promise, because there's nothing really preventing them from using that power in the future. And that's the uncertainty that creates. And that's why this is such an albatross for this industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the investment part that you underlined is chiefly important to this, because it is about the future of the internet and the pipes, as Al Gore said, the pipes there that can actually deliver us internet, and whether it be by satellite or these mobile internet stations. I've got one of these now, these 5G mobile internet. You know, that is really going to be dependent on what the rules of the game are, what the investment is, and what the private market looks like. And in fighting yesterday's battles with this kind of strange regulation, I think you bring up those valid concerns, but also, you know, they've opened the door to this. So who knows what's going to happen when there's a new FCC chairperson. Right. So I guess in terms of where this goes, is it a done deal that we're going to get? I know there's an entire process. There are comments that we can submit. But is this a done deal, considering that the sort of Democrats or broadly, the left has control right now of the FCC?
So this is where there's a fun wrinkle this time around called the major questions doctrine at the Supreme Court. So earlier I mentioned that the D.C. Circuit, right, the Court of Appeals, one layer below the Supreme Court, they upheld the putting in place of Title II. They also upheld the getting rid of Title II, right? So the message they were sending is the FCC can do either, right? They have that authority because courts traditionally, under what is known as Chevron doctrine, show deference to agencies when there is ambiguity in the law, right? So a big issue in the U.S., some probably other countries, right, is the legislature writes vague laws, kicks it over to the bureaucracy, and then they have to implement it. And because it's vague, the bureaucracy has a lot of leeway to just write stuff that's not in the law. This Supreme Court does not like that, and in particular, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh happened to be the one dissenting vote when the courts upheld the Obama rules. And what he said was that it was a major question and should be decided by Congress. Now he's a Supreme Court justice. So there was an EPA West Virginia case that a lot of observers said, okay, this is like the opening salvo in what is going to be a Supreme Court that is going to start striking down regulations that they say are not explicit from Congress. So it's a big if, right? It's not a slam dunk. And there's reasons why the Supreme Court might uphold it and say, look, broadband looks like a telecom service. The FCC is well within its rights. But you have one justice on the court already who believe that putting in place Title II monopoly-style telephone regulation, railroad-style regulation on broadband, that cannot possibly have been Congress's intent because they didn't say it. And that is the rule, right? The major question is, if it's a major question, major issue of economic significance, this industry is worth hundreds of billions of dollars, employs hundreds of thousands of people. The internet is the most important communications medium today. So of course it's a major question, right? And under that analysis, it could be that these rules get struck down by the Supreme Court. That could take a while. But in terms of the rest of the process, right, they're in the notice stage now. So they collect comments. They're required to read all of them. They also may try to rush this through because if a Republican wins the White House, wins the Senate, wins the House, they could do something called the Congressional Review Act and repeal it. And that would really hobble the FCC's ability to do this in the future.
I love that.
Of course, the funny thing, right, is that the ping pong could just happen the easy way, right? Republican wins the White House. They get a 3-2 majority at the FCC, and then they repeal the rules again, and then you and I could do another podcast about it in a couple of years.
Yeah, it's great that you mentioned the Supreme Court's view on this, because as far as I understand, the Chevron doctrine, as it up now, it's the big focus of a couple of these fisheries cases. So it's like a couple of fishermen,
yes.
You know, off the East Coast. Whatever's decided there could impact every single federal agency and how they do their rulemaking. And I think at that point, you just have to have a lot of faith and belief in the American system. Isn't it wonderful that we have separation of powers, that we have rule of law, that we can have like a good debate, not just about fisheries and whether or not they have to, I think it's pay for the patrolman to come on their boat or something like this. And that will impact future legislation and the impact of the government in your life. I think it's beautiful. It's something that I love. So kind of in closing, Evan, because you know we've hit a lot of these topics, and I'd love to get more into big tech and censorship and all this other stuff. We'll save it for another day. But you know, in terms of the way that the internet itself is going and the industry and beyond ISPs, you know, is there just a better, brighter line to where we wouldn't even really have to care about ISPs and net neutrality? You know, is there something that we could be hopeful for, even if net neutrality does come to pass and the Supreme Court doesn't weigh in time?
Yeah, bad scenario would be that these rules really do impact investment. I think a lot of that will depend on how much the companies and their investors think that future FCCs or this current FCC, how aggressive they are, right? Because the rules say X, Y, and Z, right? But ultimately, if the regulator doesn't enforce them aggressively or doesn't, you know, take wide interpretations and really crack down, then maybe it's not as bad, right? So I don't want to say like the sky is falling. I don't want to be like the net neutrality activists and say that putting in place regulation is the worst thing ever. I think we have a record that shows it's bad for investment. And when we're trying to close the digital divide, that can be a problem. I really hope that that's not the case, that this doesn't impact rural broadband investment. But just looking at the industry more broadly, right? People say ISP, you know, it's uncompetitive, it's a monopoly market. There are, unfortunately, a lot of folks in this country that only have one option for high-speed internet. That is true. But this internet ecosystem is changing rapidly. You have, as you mentioned, right, 5G in-home internet. That was not a thing, you know, even in recent memory. You have low Earth orbit satellite, which can compete with terrestrial options, right? In the past, satellite internet was so slow. It's the type of internet you get on an airplane or on a cruise ship, right? It just takes so long for the data to go to and from the satellite because the satellite's so far away from the Earth that it's, you know, lag, right, for you video gamers, right? It's a gamer's nightmare. But these Starlink and Kuiper, Amazon Kuiper and SpaceX Starlink satellites are so much closer to Earth that that lag is not a problem, right? So you're looking at those options. You're seeing more and more fixed wireless 5G, and then you have cable upgrading, and then you have fiber, right? So this is a highly competitive market. If this was such an uncompetitive market, you wouldn't see $100 billion in CapEx last year. You know, markets that are insulated from competition do not invest $100 billion, right? So even if you only have one or two options today, those providers fear the threat of entry from others and they're investing. And that's an important market discipline as well, right? The fear that others could come in and take your market share requires you to invest, which is why speeds are going up. So I think there's a lot to be optimistic about in this market despite these regulations. And hopefully that good news story carries the day in the future so that we don't have to keep doing net neutrality over and over again, because people start to realize you can take a light touch approach. You can regulate around the margins. You can have the Federal Trade Commission, the DOJ, state AGs go after things like deceptive practices, right? ISPs literally, you know, charging junk fees on consumers, that type of stuff, right? You know, no consumer wants to see that happen. You don't need Title II, this morass of regulation, to protect consumers.
There you go. Wonderfully said. A great little deep dive into net neutrality. So thank you very much. We've been talking with Evan Schwartz-Taube, Senior Advisor at the Foundation for American Innovation, and most importantly, host of the Dynamist podcast, one of my faves I love to listen to. You always bring on interesting people every week, and they've got a very, very deep insight. It's a very large brain affair. So thank you so much for that podcast. And Evan, thanks so much for your comments here today.
Thank you for having me, Yael. Always a pleasure. Just